Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're joining us this morning. In April of this year, Baltimore took a hard look back. All over town, conversations and events took place to mark the one-year anniversary of the violence and uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray. With the nomination of Catherine Pugh for mayor and a host of new faces as Democratic nominees for the Baltimore City Council, many people saw an opportunity to rethink the policies that many point to as the cause of the racial and economic inequality that led to the massive display of frustration, anger, and despair on the streets of our city in April of 2015. This morning, we revisit one of our conversations about inequality with a researcher from Johns Hopkins University who spent 10 years studying 150 young people from some of Baltimore's poorest neighborhoods. Dr. Stephanie DeLuca and two colleagues have written an eye-opening book about the ways in which poverty is caused and sustained and the ways in which it can be ameliorated. It's called Coming of Age in the Other America. Dr. DeLuca joined me in the studio on April 29th. That was just 2 days after the one-year anniversary of the riots that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray. Stephanie, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning. Good to see you.
So this is the first time, you tell us in this book, that anybody has done a study of this length, it sounds like, and it also ends up being an intergenerational study. You studied not only these kids from when they were kind of little to when they became late teens, early 20s, but you got to know a lot about their parents, too. You really found out a lot of stuff about these folks.
We did. And, you know, I have to say that I'm working in the legacy of my colleague Carl Alexander and Doris Entwistle, who had done the quarter-century-long study of the first graders in Baltimore, who were about a decade older than the young people that we profiled here. And what we did a bit differently is we went, we talked to fewer families and children and sort of got into their homes a bit more and, you know, spent more time in their communities and tracked over time, the mechanisms, the processes underneath the inequality that I think Carl and Doris so soberly profiled.
It's so easy to despair when you see some of the data. I mean, you hear things, and we heard a bunch of this data, particularly during the mayoral campaign, and before, certainly, and since the riots last year and the uprising. You know, a kid born in Harlem Park can expect to live 20 years less than the kid born in Roland Park. It is so easy to think these are intractable problems and that there's just nothing that's going to change it. But your book actually suggests something different.
Right. So I'll admit that we sat down to work on this book, which was born out of a project studying the Moving to Opportunity experiment, which gave families in five cities, including Baltimore, a chance to leave the high-rise projects that we then ended up tearing down. And so
the idea from that was to move them from these projects to areas that had less crime,
that
less
were
poverty.
Lower poverty, right. And while that's certainly featured prominently in the book, I think what struck us while we were in the field, during our meetings, during the writing, was this incredible resilience, this brightness, this deep humanity, this grit that these young people displayed. And it was so hard to ignore that. It was so hard to figure out how do you write a book and just get out of the way of these kids' amazing stories. And what I think we realized is that this is where the potential lies. It's sitting right in front of us. It's right there. You know, these young people have moved mountains that many of us will never come near. And yet, at the brink of adulthood, even our most promising young people struggle mightily in the face of institutions that underserve them.
Just a couple of days ago on the show, we had two entrepreneurs who have moved here recently from Oakland, California, women named Aisha Pugh and B. Cole. And they talked about how it's so often the case that people use these micro stories to tell a macro story that is often incorrect. That the micro story of, you know, the kid pouncing on the police cruiser or, you know, cutting the fire hose during the uprising does not tell the story of the African-American community. In overall, what do your micro, because this book is chock full of micro stories. You know, you get to know these young people by name, you know, first name at least, and you you hear this very interesting and diverse web of different kinds of experiences. What do you think the macro story is that gets told from all these micro stories in this book?
Well, it's interesting that you bring it up that way. So we tell lots of micro stories, right? And as sociologists, we had a systematic approach to collecting them. And I think the strength in that approach, it allows us to, you know, to say what's going on broadly for a group of young people who share disadvantaged origins. Not, let's take a look at what's happening outside on the corner. Let's take a look at kids who are, you know, only delinquent kids, only high school dropouts, only those who were throwing things, you know, a week ago last year at police cars. So when you, I think what happens is when we focus only on the most aggravating, threatening images, you know, of inner city life, it leads people who have spent no time in these communities to believe that that extreme is the norm, that that exception is the norm. And in fact, what we uncover in some ways is, you know, is not surprising at all to many of the people who live in these communities, which is that these young adults are adhering, you know, strongly to mainstream values and goals about education and work. It only comes as a surprise, I think, to, you know, the many middle-class neighbors who never set foot in these communities, right? This idea that we are separated by geography and segregation has serious consequences for, you know, how we view their potential. And I think most people don't go beyond, you know, television images and quick, you know, media images to say, I wonder what it's really like there.
Dr. Stephanie DeLuca is an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the co-author, along with Susan Clampett-Lundquist and Catherine Eden, of Coming of Age in the Other America. It's interesting how this notion that folks in the middle class who have no interaction with people in economically impoverished neighborhoods, it seems like it's becoming hip now to start paying attention and to understand. I know David Brooks, of all people, wrote about this very thing just a couple of days ago. One of the myths that you shatter is, and you've just alluded to it, is that most kids are not, in fact, drawn to the life of the street. They're not drawn to be drug dealers so that they can make more money if they were working at McDonald's for minimum wage. That's the exception, not the rule, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, David Brooks was writing about, the, you know, Baltimore and youth, you know, about a year ago as well, and really focused on the norms in these communities that were missing, saying, you know, will these young people, you know, are they bondage to their desires, or they can they exercise self-control? And I think, you know, implicating norms and values. And I think, you know, if anything, we found that that's not the problem, right? Because, you know, over 80% of the young people in our study were working or in school by the time the study ended, right? It was the few who had turned to the street, you know, and if anything, it was, you know, the street and working on the corner was the last thing, you know, that a young man or woman wanted to end up doing, right? And by, you know, the early 2000s, you know, young people in Baltimore were scorning that kind of a lifestyle in favor of becoming certified nursing assistants, bus drivers, police officers, chefs, you know, forensic scientists, the kinds of things that we know kids across America are also interested in becoming.
Tell us what an identity project is.
So the identity project was the surprise of our study. We went into the study, you know, focused on families and neighborhoods and schools, and, you know, and how do these social contexts matter for young adults? And what came back strongly to us from these young people was what they were already bringing to the table, which were, you know, these vital, sometimes private, sometimes public activities that ranged from Dana Jenkins, you know, 10 years old in her bedroom using her dad's old VCR, taping what she called Dana's TV show, where she would just sit down and talk about boys or the new poetry she had written, and then do this over and over again over middle school. And her mom, she and her mom can look back now and they sort of laugh and say, remember when? You know, something private like that, you know, or something that's, you know, more structured. Like Cody had become involved in the Police Explorers organization, and so he proudly wore a badge to say, you know, this is what I'm about. And we do these training scenarios. And, you know, this for Cody, this kind of of Identity Project tied him into a structured organization that had potential connections to a job later on. He was also involved in the junior ROTC there. For a number of other young men, employment was the Identity Project. That badge, the security guard uniform were really strong signals to the rest of the community about what they were doing. And so sometimes these were private escapes, like Vicky building pigeon coops in the backyard, you know, or Dana's TV show. And sometimes they were much more tied to institutions, you know, like some of the career academies at school or some of these community groups. And we found that the latter, these structured, more structured institutionally based identity projects were much more predictive of staying on track by the time our study ended.
And the thing is, you have an identity project. I have an identity project. Anybody who has, I mean, for you, it's your work. For me, it's, you know, I'm a professional musician. I mean, all that. Everybody who's successful has one, including these kids in these neighborhoods. And the ones that have them, they're the ones that have been able to break out and stop the cycle of intergenerational poverty.
At least as far as we could see, they came to this brink of adulthood ready to launch. You know, the ones who had had these identity projects were much more likely to be pursuing work and career, work and school. But as we also note in the book, you know, the grit that they displayed that was inspired by these identity projects, it's not enough alone, right? That narrative is limited to say it's just about grit. I mean, we really have to meet them halfway so that they can, you know, take this incredible potential and roll with it.
You talk about getting them to the table, but we got to have policies that help us, you know, get them to the to finish the race. Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating read, and I really appreciate your coming by.
Yeah,
thanks
so much.
Thank
you for having me.
Dr. Stephanie DeLuca is Associate Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the co-author, along with Susan Clampett Lundquist and Catherine Eden, of Coming of Age in the Other America. We spoke last spring. Dr. DeLuca will be speaking at the Enoch Pratt Free Library on September 20th at 6:30 and at the Barnes & Noble in Charles Village on October 18th. We've got links to those events and to her book. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for news, we'll hear another conversation I recorded last April with author and musician James McBride about his latest book, a biography of one of the most influential figures in the history of American music, James Brown. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.